On this edition of Celebrating Science, Sir Roger Penrose on what may have come before the Big Bang. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit, scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, Before the Big Bang, is there evidence for something, and if so, what? Sir Roger Penrose describes a very different hypothesis from that of inflationary cosmology, one that suggests a succession of universes prior to our own. Dr. Penrose is a mathematical physicist and professor at Oxford University. He received his PhD in mathematics from Cambridge in 1958 and is the recipient of numerous prizes and honors, recognizing his many contributions to science. Sir Roger is also a founding member of Perimeter Institute, having served on its first International Scientific Advisory Committee. He is also a prolific book author and enjoys sharing his ideas with the wider community.
It's a great pleasure to be back in Waterloo and to have the opportunity to spout about something that means something to me. I hope it... There's the question, which we've just had. And so the question is it crazy? And the answer is yes. But it does have relation to a lot of topics. It has something to say about all the things that I have here. I'll touch on most of them, not necessarily at any depth, but I'll certainly have something to say about these issues. Second law of thermodynamics will certainly feature strongly. The fact that there's a positive cosmological constant, or dark energy, if you like to call it that, is essential for the picture, although I won't say much about that. There's the other mysterious thing, which seems to be what the universe is mostly constructed of. Dark matter, it probably has something to say about that, but I won't say very much about that one. The microwave background, yes, I'll have some comments on that. And I notice here, without inflation. Inflation has become one of the standard ingredients of modern cosmology, that the universe was supposed to have expanded much more violently in its very early history. And that's to explain various features of this microwave background, which... I have a different explanation for, if the idea, crazy idea, makes sense. Black holes evaporating away, and that is a key thing I want to talk about. And, well, whether mass does or not, I may say something about that, yes. But there's another question here which I want to raise, and that is it true? Well... I'm going to, at the end of the talk, I'm going to address this question a little bit, and I think I'm going to ask you for the answer, but we'll see what comes up. Let me talk about other models that have been put forward various times in which the universe didn't actually start with a Big Bang, but there was something before it. This is perhaps the first one of the very earliest cosmological models in accordance with Einstein's equations was put forward by Friedman. It was referred to as the oscillating model of the universe. You see, most of my diagrams will be with time going up the page, so you better get used to that. Space is going this way, time's that way. So you see, here we have a model. There's a sort of Big Bang. The universe is closed, you see. Of course, I can only draw it as a circle, but you have to imagine that's got several dimensions. It's three-dimensional. And then it contracts back down again to what's called a big crunch, and then it bounces and goes on again. It was called the oscillating model, really, because the function which describes the radius as a function of time is what's called a cycloid, and you get that by rolling a circle on a line and putting a point on the circle, and it traces out this curve. And since the circle keeps on going, you expect the universe to keep on going. So that's a possibility. It doesn't take into account this thing, the second law of thermodynamics, which, as I say, will be a strong thing here. I'll say more about that later. But the second law tells you that something called entropy is increasing with time, and so you have to accommodate that somehow. Tolman was an American physicist and astronomer, cosmologist, and he had the idea that you could, in this particular model of his, in which by having these phases getting bigger and bigger, you could actually take into account, at some level, the second law of thermodynamics. John Wheeler, who's an American physicist, put forward an idea that something like this might hold, but where the constants of nature might somehow get juggled around each time. There are reasons why people might like to want to do this. Partly, well, the idea often comes up that the constants of nature seem to be organized so in order that life could exist, and maybe they were something else in some other phase, and we only happen to inhabit one of these phases where life can exist, because we couldn't be in any of the others, because if light can't exist, well, you know what I'm saying. There are other models. I have some contributions from people at the Perimeter Institute. Here's one, Lee Smolin, a very ingenious idea, where you have these things sort of sprouting off in different directions. Each time you get a black hole, which is another time you get a singularity, then you can sprout off new universes. It's a very clever idea. I have trouble with it because I can't make the geometry fit very well. Veneziano has a model not unlike mine in some respects, and also Steinhardt, and here we have Neil, a model which is in many respects like what I want to say, in the sense that there is a pre-Big Bang and the universe seems to go through cycles of some kind. There is, however, an important difference between all of these and what I want to say. Here we have the universe collapsing to what you call a big crunch, and then it sort of bounces and comes out. Well, mine's different, and I'll try and explain something about that. But before doing so, let me describe again the Friedman models, the original ones, 1922, solutions of the famous Einstein equations. And there were basically three of them, depending upon the spatial curvature. Now you see, time is going this way, so here's I'm only taking one phase of the what's so-called oscillating model, but here you see the space is closed up in this. Here we have a model, K describes the spatial curvature. You see this is positively curved, so closed up in a positively curved sense. Here we have flat sections, these are meant to be Euclidean spaces, and this expands indefinitely. And then there's another model here, having what are called hyperbolic sections. Now, just to describe a bit of those geometries, I think I'll show you some pictures. Very nice that the Dutch artist Escher, M.C. Escher, had a very nice way of describing all these geometries. Here we have the closed-up spherical one. Of course, it's only in two dimensions. You have to imagine a few more dimensions. You'll have to do that quite a bit in my talk, so get used to it. Here we have a flat one, and here we have this hyperbolic geometry. He's managed to illustrate all these with what look like the same collections of devils and angels. It's very clever. I'm going to say something about this, not because I believe the universe is this. It may or it may not be. In fact, we don't really know. The evidence points to something very close to this case, the flat case. But in a certain sense, that's the worst case, because it might just be one way or the other. So we don't really know. It might be this, it might be this, or it might be this. So that's a good question. But I'm not going to worry about that because it doesn't have much. My particular scheme, which I'm going to describe, works for any of these models, so I'm not going to worry about that. But what I am going to do is take advantage of this Escher picture to describe something which is going on in this kind of geometry. You see, here we have the entire spatial geometry of this world. Okay, it's two dimensions, but the entire two-dimensional geometry that these angels and devils inhabit, including right up to infinity, you see. That's the whole universe. If you are a devil, or if you prefer an angel, and you see you might have been this one over here, well, you'd think you were just the same as the one in the middle. So the geometry's all been squashed up at the edge. But it's been squashed up in a very particular way, which is called conformal. That means that small shapes are accurately represented. Well, of course, the devils, you can see they do get a little bit distorted, but let's take the eye of the devil here. You find the eye, well, you can't probably see it, but never mind. The eye of the devils would be virtually the same shape as this eye, but smaller. So shapes, or angles, if you like, are accurately represented in this. It's called a conformal representation for that reason. Now, you see, this is infinity. There are, if this was completely precisely drawn, there would be an infinite number of devils going right up there. But you or I, if that was on the floor, and you might take a walk, you might go take a step right outside the edge of that universe. And you would be respecting the conformal geometry, that is to say, the shapes and all that sort of stuff. As I say, they're correctly represented, but nevertheless, you can step right out beyond infinity. Okay, I want you to keep that in mind, because that's something which is going to play a role in what I'm going to talk about. The mystery of the second law of thermodynamics. Well, the second law of thermodynamics, what does it say? It says more or less that things get more and more random as time goes on. You don't think that's a mystery, because we all know things get worse and worse as time goes on. That's more or less, we all know that. I want to say a bit more about the second law in a little bit of detail. Well, it's useful to describe it in terms of various cartoons. You see, here we have a glass of wine sitting on the edge of the table. It topples off, the wine spills out, and the glass smashes on the ground. Now, we could imagine this is taking place according to the dynamics of Newton. So you've got particles running around acting according to forces and so on and so forth. But the thing about the equations of Newton is that they are reversible in time. So that means you could have a situation completely consistent with Newton's equations, where it started with the wine smashed up, absorbed into the carpet, the glass smashed up. Suddenly it jumps up in the air, the glass assembles itself, the wine all collects itself into the glass, and it sits on the corner of the table. That would be completely consistent with Newton's equations. However, you never see that kind of thing. And the way we describe that is to say, well, there's this thing called entropy, which is in a sense a measure of disorder, and this entropy increases with time. That's the second law, it says that. And okay, the entropy here, it has a certain value. Here, it's a bit more, and there it's a bit more still. So this is consistent with the second law of thermodynamics, but this is not. So, look, that doesn't, I'm just saying it, so what does it mean? Well, let me try and say a bit more about this law. I'm going to try and explain what it is, or what entropy is. It's one of these notions which, in a certain sense, is a very simple notion and a very universal type of notion. In another sense, it's completely mysterious. So I'll try and do my best with it. Well, there's a definition according to the great Austrian physicist Boltzmann, and he produced this definition here. The entropy is this thing called S. I never could figure out why entropy was S, but never mind. The entropy, S, is basically a logarithm of a volume. And the question is, what is this volume? Well, in order to describe that volume, I have to describe a thing called phase space. Now, what is phase space? Well, it's a huge space. You see, these are three-dimensional spaces. Of course, I've only drawn them flat, but never mind about that. They're three-dimensional spaces. Phase space is a space of an absolutely enormous number of dimensions. In fact, there's one dimension for every degree of freedom in this picture here. Now, what does that mean? Let's suppose there are a lot of particles, and I'll suppose the particles here are all point particles. Each particle has a location which will require three coordinates to describe where it is. So it's height off here, and it's distance this way, and distance this way. Three numbers for each particle. And also that particle will be moving with a certain speed in a certain direction. Three more numbers to tell you how it's moving. Six numbers for each particle, okay? Now, let's suppose there are a zillion particles. I don't know what a zillion is, it doesn't matter. Let's suppose there are a zillion particles to describe the situation here. Then there would have to be six zillion numbers to describe where every single particle is and how every single particle is moving. So phase space has one dimension for each degree of freedom here. So there will be 6 zillion dimensions here. Now you look at that picture. I haven't drawn it very well because I've only drawn it on a flat plane. I should really have drawn it in 6 zillion dimensions. Well, I can't, you see, so that's why I didn't. But anyway, this is phase space. And you see, as this system evolves, does this, then it does this, then this, there will be a point in this phase space representing the state of that system. And Newton, according to his dynamical laws, tells you where that point will move the next moment. So it will go along some curve in this space here. Now, what I've done is I've divided this space up into a lot of regions. Now, what are these regions here? They're called coarse-graining regions. These are regions where if you take any 2 points in those one of those regions, so there'll be 2 different systems of particles, as far as macroscopic parameters are concerned, they look the same. So you see, it might be that this little particle was not here, it was over there. I don't care about that. It might have been moving this way or not that way. I don't care about that. The only thing I really care about is the temperature, say, the chemical composition of the gas, of the wine, the direction of the general motion of the gas, and so on. All these things are macroscopic parameters, things that you can measure. However, the details of where all the particles are, I lump them all together. So if you look at this region here, that describes many, many different configurations and motions, which all look the same. It's a bit vague, that, but never mind, that'll do. And so this yellow region here, which is supposed to represent what's going on in here, all the different ways that the little molecules might be are all lumped together in the same region. Now, the volume of that region, that's a volume in some huge number of dimensions, 6 zillion dimensions, never mind about that. That volume is what I then take the logarithm of, and then I multiply by this tiny constant called Boltzmann's constant, and I get the entropy. Now, one thing to bear in mind about this picture is it's very badly drawn. It's very badly drawn, partly because it's not the right number of dimensions, but also because these regions don't look very different from each other. That one's a bit bigger than that one, and a bit smaller than that one, and so on. You've got to bear in mind that the big ones are absolutely stupendously larger than the slightly smaller ones in this picture. So that if you start there and wiggle around some old way, and you are likely to get into a bigger region, and this one looks a bit bigger than that, but you've got to bear in mind it's really absolutely, fantastically, stupendously bigger than that. So once it gets into that region, the chance of finding its way back into this one is almost zero. Almost zero. But then this one is surrounded by others, and there are a lot of others which are stupendously huger than this one. And so it's likely to find its way into those stupendously larger ones, and this will just keep on going. So what we see then is the entropy, which doesn't get so much bigger for 2 reasons. One is because it's a logarithm here, and numbers can be much bigger, and the log doesn't change very much. And the other is this tiny little number k here. So the entropy goes up a little bit, but that means that the volume that you've gone into has gone up absolutely stupendously, and you're not going to find the smaller one again just by jiggling around. Okay, so that's the second law. Whatever value you are now, the entropy is likely to go up. Now, there's a snag about that. The snag is that I've asked a particular type of question, which is, what's going to happen to this situation? Well, it's probably going to do that. But suppose I ask a different question. Suppose I find the glass here sitting on the edge of the table and ask the question, what's the most likely way it got there? Well, you look at this argument here and say, well, there are lots and lots of lines moving into that. The most likely way was it started, well, the answer you come out with, the most likely way is it started a mess on the floor like that, with the wine all absorbed into the carpet, and the wine suddenly found its way into the glass, and the glass suddenly assembled itself, and it jumped up like that with the wine jumping into it, and it went on the edge like that. That's the most likely way it came about. And that's the entropy going up again back into the past. That's not what happened. What happened? Well, somebody had been evidently drinking a bit too much of this stuff, sort of put it on the edge of the table, and it fell off. But that is consistent with the second law. That is, that the entropy prior to this was even lower. So it came from some smaller region, and from smaller and smaller and smaller region. So this argument, which I've just given you, doesn't explain that. In fact, the entropy was much lower in the past. It didn't go up in the past. Now, that would violate the second law, you see. So I haven't finished. The explanation only works in the future. It's no good at all as far as the past is concerned. In fact, what we've got to do now is to chase back and see where this curve went. And we find that it went back to the Big Bang. Okay. Well, I think I'll even close that up for a bit. Here we are. To ensure that the entropy continues to go down in the past, we need an enormous constraint on the space-time. Well, I'll explain about the geometry first. There was a constraint. It had to go down, for some reason, to a very low entropy. The entropy at the beginning must have been very, very low. Well, how do we know there was a Big Bang anyway? Well, one of the most powerful pieces of evidence for the existence of the Big Bang is this, I mentioned it before, the thing called the microwave radiation. This is radiation coming to us from deep space in all directions. It's often referred to as the flash of the Big Bang, cooled down because the universe expanded and that cooled it down. That's slightly misleading because it was actually about 300,000 years after the Big Bang. Well, never mind, it's pretty well the flash. Okay, 300,000 years, that's nothing in all these lengths of time one think about in this context. But I want to tell you something about this microwave radiation. It's coming at us from all directions in space. And here is a graph of going up this way, the intensity, and going this way, of the different frequencies of the radiation. It's, when I say radiation, I mean it's light, really. But it's light of various different frequencies. And electromagnetic radiation of various different frequencies. And this solid curve here is a thing called the Planck curve. And the observations of different frequencies, well, these lines going up and down up here are the error bars. So they're telling you how far off the observations are. But there's something I should mention about this. The error bars are exaggerated by a factor of 500. So you see, well, even the worst one down here, if you shrink that line down by a factor of 500, it's going to hug the curve. So these observations hug that curve with a precision that you can't even see, that isn't exact looking at it. Now, what does that mean? What does the Planck curve mean? Well, the Planck curve, this was a great achievement that Max Planck did, started quantum mechanics off. But I'm not going to say much about that here. What it's telling you is that this radiation we see came from what's called thermal equilibrium. So there was matter and radiation in thermal equilibrium. Now, what's thermal equilibrium? Thermal equilibrium is the largest region in this phase-space volume. In fact, it tends to be, for most systems, it tends to be so huge that it is much larger than all the others put together. So that it's where your curve ends up in. It's easily the maximum entropy state. Maximum entropy state. Wasn't this curve supposed to be going down and down and down in the past? And it reached, apparently, a state which was maximum entropy. Well, you don't have to be much of a mathematician to realize there's something funny going on there. It was supposed to be a minimum or a very small entropy, but what we seem to see is a maximum entropy. Well, the reason for that, I'm often puzzled about why cosmologists didn't worry more about this. And I think they had this sort of feeling that, well, in the old days, the universe was pretty small and maybe there wasn't much room for much entropy. That's not the right answer. The right answer, as one can see from various reasons, the right answer is something completely different. It is to do with, well, you see, what did I say this describing? The matter and radiation was in thermal equilibrium. But there's something else, even more important about the initial universe, which is also indicated by this microwave background, but not by this curve. It's the fact that it's uniform. It comes to us very, very almost the same temperature from all directions, very, very uniform. And that's telling us that the universe in the early stages was very, very uniform. And I have now another cartoon. See, often the second law of thermodynamics is described, well, I'll cover this up for the moment, in terms of a gas in a box. And you could imagine that this gas was initially tucked up in one corner with some compartments there. Then you remove the compartments, and the gas then spreads out uniformly throughout the box. Now, this corresponds to entropy increasing, and that's fine. That's the sort of picture we expect. When you get thermal equilibrium, it'll be all spread out uniformly, pretty uniformly over the box. However, suppose these aren't simply gas molecules, but gravitating bodies. They might be stars or something like that. Then you have a counter tendency. They tend to clump. Gravity is a universally attractive force, and it tends to pull things together. And so you have an opposite tendency. It's still entropy increasing as time increases, but it gets more and more clumpy. So what we see about the early universe is some kind of combination of this and this. The microwave background, the Planck curve tells us it's thermal equilibrium as far as the matter is concerned. The uniformity of this microwave background is telling us that as far as gravity is concerned, it's low entropy. So what we see is something like a combination of these two pictures. And it is very low entropy with regard to gravity. In fact, here we have a black hole, which represents a huge increase in the entropy. Let me say how important this gravitational thing is, because, well, you see, we're all here for a good reason. One of the good reasons is, well, the sun. The sun's jolly useful to us. It keeps us warm and things like that. But it's somehow a bit misleading. People think, well, we get energy from the sun. You often hear people say that. We get energy from the sun. But the Earth as a whole does not get energy from the sun, because energy is conserved, and it throws away as much energy as it gets. See, because otherwise it would just get hotter and hotter and hotter. Well, it is getting a bit hotter because of global warming, but at this level, important as though that is, it's not a big factor in this picture, you see. So you have to imagine that the energy is really pretty well conserved. As much energy goes back into space from the Earth as comes in from the sun. However, the sun is much hotter than the background sky, and this means that the photons which come from sun, well, this is the Planck formula, which E equals H nu, which tells us the energy is related to the frequency, and the frequency here is higher because it's hotter than the background sky, which means that the photons that come from the sun are individually, by Planck's formula, individually much more energetic than the ones that go back. So you get comparatively few photons of high energy individually, and comparatively many photons of lower energy individually going away. And the plants are very clever at taking advantage of this and converting these high energy photons to lower ones and building up their substance. So what it is, it's the entropy. That's the important thing. This was a point made by Schrödinger in his little book, What is Life? A very important point that was, I think, often misunderstood, but a crucial issue, that we get essentially energy in a low entropy form. And you can see that because there are relatively few photons coming in, carrying away the same energy as this relatively larger photons, number of photons going out. And so there are many more degrees of freedom here than there are here, much bigger phase space volume here than here, much bigger entropy here than here. So that it's the low entropy in the hot spot that the sun is in this otherwise dark sky. The sun is a hot spot in a dark sky. Why is it a hot spot in a dark sky? Well, there are all sorts of processes going on, thermonuclear reactions in the sun and so on and so forth. But the important thing about the sun is it's there at all. And it's there because it's held together by gravity. Previously, there was a very much more uniform distribution which clumped into the sun. And as it did that, the sun got hot. And it got hot by comparison with the background. Okay, thermonuclear reactions were taking place, but they tended, actually what they did is to slow down. If they weren't there, the sun would have contracted much more rapidly, got much hotter, and wouldn't have been any use to us. So, okay, the thermonuclear reactions are important to us, but the fact that the sun is there at all is a gravitational thing, and it's It's the gravitational clumping that's important. So we are living off that, and it's this process that I just described, this clumpingness, which is the way in which we manage to keep ourselves going and keep our entropy down, which is the crucial thing. Okay, black hole, what's that? I've got to tell you what a black hole is. Well, in order to explain what a black hole is properly, I have to tell you something else, which is about space-time a bit more. I'd got your space-time pictures of the universe and all that, but let me say a little bit more about space-time. So here's space-time, and there's what's called a light cone. This is a crucial thing about space-time, and I want to describe this here. This is meant to be space, and you see, as time progresses, you think of the space going up like this. So you think of this then as intersecting that light cone, and then you have an intersection. Well, in this picture, it looked like a circle, but you have to imagine another dimension, so it's really a sphere, goes down to a point, and then expands out again. And that's a flash of light converging on this point and then expanding out. So I have another picture of that here, which is this one. And there we have light cone. This is the spatial description as time progresses. Now, in Einstein's special relativity, without any gravity, all these light cones are more or less arranged in a uniform way. And here we have a massive particle. See, one of the things about relativity is that you're not supposed to be able to go faster than light. That means that your world line, or particle's world line, which that represents the history of that particle, that's what a world line is, has to be always pointing inside the cone. That's what it means. So it is traveling faster than the light, which is described by the sides of the cone here. Light itself goes along tangent to the cone everywhere. So that's the basic point about special relativity. Describes the causality properties of a space. General relativity is just the same, except that these light cones are sort of all higgledy-piggledy. Well, they can be higgledy-piggledy. They're a bit more... They don't have to be uniformly arranged, and this has to do with gravity. Well, let me describe that now in the particular case of a black hole. So here we have collapse to a black hole, and notice that these light cones are tipped over in slightly strange ways. This, again, time is going more or less up the picture there. Here we have a body, say a star or something like that, collapsing, and it gets to a point where the light cones are in some sense dragged in by the gravitational field of the star until they become tangential to this surface, which is called an event horizon. Now, the thing is that if you're inside the event horizon, you can't escape, because to escape, you would have to travel faster than light. You'd have to have a world line which goes outside the light cone, you see, like this. And that's not allowed. Your world line has to be pulled inwards, and once you've got in, there's no way of escaping the event horizon. Even worse is that there's this thing called a singularity. I talked about singularities in the Big Bang. Roughly speaking, think of a singularity as a place where densities are liable to go to infinite values, and space-time curvatures, I have to say a little bit more about that, become infinite also. But basically, you'd be crushed out of existence. It's not a happy time to have if you go inside a black hole. I don't recommend it. Okay, now I've got to improve my not very well-drawn picture of the universe, and it might even be worse if I've lost it. That's not so good, is it? It should be staring me in the face, which it is indeed. Here we are. Here we have model of the... I'm going to prove this picture now by introducing the black hole singularities. So here we have these singularities. Lots of black holes will form as time goes on, and that will happen in all the models. It's particularly dramatic and messy in the case of the closed universe, because here all these black holes will start coming together and congealing in the great mess. So I've drawn it as a great mess. So that's the sort of thing you've got to expect. However, these pictures are badly drawn in yet another respect. This is an important development which has taken place Well, 1998, these people here and some others began to reveal a fact about the universe, that it seems to have what's called a cosmological constant. That's what we in the trade, and when I say the trade, I mean general relativity, used to call it. We still call it that, but some other people in slightly different trades call it dark energy. So you'll see it in the, often referred to as dark energy. I'm not terribly keen on that term, but so I'll call it the cosmological constant. Of course, it's a bit more of a mouthful to call it the cosmological constant, but people tend to call it the mysterious dark energy, and that's as much of a mouthful as the cosmological constant. So let's live with that. Anyway, so that's a thing called lambda, and it seems to have a positive value. And having a positive value means that all these models, which had this nice distinct way of behaving from each other, including one having this big crunch, which is nice to talk about, even though not very nice to be in, they all expand in this exponential way. So it's an expansion which takes over, and this just keeps on going. So we have a slightly improved picture with these cosmological constants descriptions, and I now got to improve them by putting the black holes in. So here we are. Those are pretty good pictures of the, well, they're not all that good, but pretty good pictures of the universe. Okay? Now I want to say something about the second law. You see, you've got singularities in the past, the Big Bang in each of these models, and singularities in the future, which basically are the experience of somebody who falls in the black hole. You see, if you were foolish enough to fall into this black hole, then your future is that singularity, and you hit it pretty soon. Okay, so you got them in the future and you got them in the past. And so what's the difference? Why is it that this one in the past corresponds to very low entropy, something very, very special, whereas these in the future seem to be very, very general? Well, I'm going to give you a sort of first attempt at how we're going to distinguish these. And this is in terms of a thing which is called the Weyl conformal curvature. Well, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that, but whatever it is, the point is that it seems to become infinite in the future, in these black hole singularities, and it seems to have been pretty small, if not zero, in the past. Now, if you simply postulate that the singularities in the future are allowed to do what they like, and this Weyl curvature thing, it's called C, that can go infinite. Okay, that corresponds to high entropy, whereas the Weyl curvature in the past somehow has got to be very small or zero. If that's the case, then you find that the initial state is special to an extraordinary degree. Now, I can't go into the very details of how you do the calculations on this. It depends on the Bekenstein-Hawking formula for the entropy of a black hole. And this black hole has an extraordinarily high entropy, and you find that it tends to be the largest sort of entropy you find around. So in terms of the phase space volume, what it means is that the volume of this thing as a whole is going to be a very, very large, and you can estimate that by supposing all the matter in the universe, or in how much we can observe in the universe, might be clumped together into a black hole. And that gives you a sort of volume here. And then you say, what about the size of the Big Bang region? It's a lot smaller than that. How much smaller is it? How much is this entropy going to be small in the early stages? How much smaller? Well, it's about, I mustn't lose my transparency here. Here we are. The precision in that starting off the universe is one part in at least something like this. 10 to the power, 123, well, that's the sort of baryonic matter, the kind of matter we know about, but there's all this mysterious dark matter which pushes this up even to 124. It doesn't make much difference. Actually, it makes an absolutely stupendous difference. But as far as the argument is concerned, it doesn't make any difference. Let me just tell you, this is a pretty big number, because suppose I try to write the whole number out with one zero on each proton in the observable units. It wouldn't nearly make it. There aren't nearly enough protons in the observable universe. So that's just giving you some idea how big it is. But that's telling you how precise that initial universe was organized to be. Well, for the moment, I'm just going to say, let's try to characterize this initial state. Well, it seems to be that this thing called the Weyl curvature was small or zero or something. Now, what I'm going to try and describe the Weyl curvature to you. I think one of the nicest ways of doing it is the following. Weyl, I should say, is spelt with a W, in case you didn't know. And the rest of the curvature is something called Ricci curvature. And these two things play a role, like a bit like in the theory of electromagnetism. You have electric and magnetic fields. This is the gravitational analog of that, the Weyl curvature. And then you've got the source, the charges, the currents. That's like the Ricci part. Einstein's theory tells you that the Ricci part is what matter itself does. The Weyl part is the gravitational field outside it. So if here's, I've got a picture of the sun. Inside the sun, you've got lots of this Ricci stuff, the blue one. Outside, you've got this Weyl curvature. Now, you can actually see it. This is the point that I'm going to try and make here. Well, first of all, let me just put this on to tell you that. The Ricci curvature is in the middle there, and the Weyl curvature is outside. What do I mean by seeing it? Well, you see, this is a space-time picture of the sun. Time going up the page again. So that the sun, it looks like a tube here in space-time. That's the sun now, that's the sun tomorrow, and so on. Okay? Now, somebody looking, I wouldn't recommend looking at the sun, but you know what you're supposed to do. You have something in the way. And the best thing to do is to have an eclipse. Then you can, there was a famous expedition where Eddington had a look to see if Einstein's theory was right, because Einstein's theory predicted that the sun would bend light by the curvature of space. That was the idea. So here I have two stars in the remote distance, and the light coming from them to some observer, and it's bent inwards like this. Now that means that this observer, since that angle here is bigger than it would have been without the sun, means that these stars look further apart than they would have without the sun there. Well, during this eclipse, Eddington's expedition was able to observe that the stars were sort of pushed out a bit in accordance with Einstein's theory. Well, here I have a picture of this sort of happening. You see that if you could look through the sun, you would see the sun would act like a sort of magnifying glass. It would push outwards the image behind it. And that's what Ricci does. It magnifies. Whereas Weyl, that gravitational field part, distorts. So you see that outside, the images will be pushed outwards, but they're also stretched this way because, well, they've got to keep to within these same lines. So what you find is that a circular pattern would become stretched into an elliptical pattern. And that is looking through Weyl curvature does that to you. And in the space-time picture, you have this here. Well, I want to try to convince you that there is really Weyl curvature out there. I hope you can see that there is a sort of stretching. You see, a massive body here, from what I was showing you, would cause things to get a little stretched, according to this picture, which I just showed you a minute ago. Now, one of the troubles with galaxies is that they're already rather elliptical on the whole. So if they're stretched, if that particular galaxy is stretched, you wouldn't know, because it might be just a stretched galaxy after all. So how do you know it's stretched? So what you have to do is a lot of complicated statistics to work out whether on average they're more stretched out in a kind of ring than normally. Either that or you just look at it. And if you're lucky, just looking at it will tell you, look, you can see a sort of tendency for the things to be stretched out all the way around there. And that is because there's a body in the middle here, a lot closer than these distant galaxies here, which is actually causing this Weyl curvature stretching effect. So you can see the Weyl curvature. It's this stretching of the field behind it. That's rather amazing. I always thought that was really amazing. It's an effect predicted by Einstein, but I think he thought nobody would ever see it. But indeed, you can see it. Here's another one. Perhaps a little harder to see the effect, but indeed, there is this sort of stretching out like that. And if you still don't believe me, there is a pretty convincing case here of something. there's this mass in the middle here, which has stretched out something which probably looked fairly round in actuality, but it's been stretched right out like that because of this vial curvature effect. So it's there, and it's indeed, in accordance with Einstein, it's that kind of distorting curvature which measures the strength of the gravitational field. Okay, so there's this thing which I'm calling the vial curvature hypothesis, which is just a hypothesis. It's saying that the vial curvature in near a singularity in the past, that is like the Big Bang, won't have much, if any, vial curvature in it, whereas the ones in the future have lots of it. And the entropy in the gravitational field is going up when the vial curvature goes up. So that's the general idea. Now, I want to give you a formulation. See, that thing that I just said, I said it, you know, reasonably easily, but if you want to do mathematics with that, it's not so easy. There's another way of describing this vial curvature hypothesis, which is essentially due to a colleague of mine called Paul Todd, and I want to give you his formulation. The things that I'm describing here are more or less what I've just been saying. The vial curvature hypothesis gives you a constraint on the Big Bang to something like 1 part in 10 to the 10 to the 124. And this is the formula that I was just describing from the Bekenstein-Hawking formula. And it tells us that if you impose that condition, that its vial curvature should be zero at the Big Bang, that the second law in the sort of form we know it would have held. It's not an explanation for why it was. It's just a hypothesis. Now, Paul Todd has a different way of describing this. And it's a very elegant way, which gets around these kind of mathematical problems that I was saying. And that is described in the following way. Here's the Big Bang. These are the singularities in black holes. That it's possible to stretch out the Big Bang in a way which preserves the conformal geometry of space-time, such that it's smooth. Now, bear in mind this picture. It's very much like this. This picture is a little different because here I was talking about infinity, but you can do the same trick to a singularity if you're lucky. And that's what we're trying to do here. We're representing the singularity by stretching it out. I mean, here it's the other way around because you're squashing infinity down. But in this picture, you can stretch infinity out. And the hypothesis now is that that it's completely smooth when you've done that. But of course, you've got to say that you're really doing this with the kind of geometry which I was describing here, which is, you know, the eye of the devil is drawn right here, except it's the wrong size, if you like, you see. The conformal geometry preserves shapes. Now, what does that mean in space-time terms? Well, in space-time terms, I should tell you, you see, I talked about light cones. Here's the light cone. And the light cone isn't quite all the geometry, because the light cone is described by 9 out of 10 components in the metric. There's a thing called the metric. This metric thing describes how you measure distances and so on in your geometry. And in four-dimensional space-time, it has 10 components. There are 10 numbers you need to describe it. Now, 9 of these are simply telling you where that light cone is. Remember my light cones wiggling all over the place in this picture here? So the 9 of the components are telling you where that thing sits. The 10th component is telling you a scaling. And what's that doing for you? Well, it's telling you how fast clocks tick. So here I've got a green clock. And this is its 0, first tick, second tick, third tick. Here is a brown clock whizzing by, 0, first tick, second tick, third tick. And these bowl-shaped regions are telling you all different clocks moving in with different speeds through this point. That's why it tilted at different angles here. These tell you the first tick, the second tick, and the third tick. So I need the crowding of these surfaces as the remaining component. Let me put this a slightly different way by referring to this picture which I had before. Here we have the light cones. And I said that describes space-time geometry. Well, it doesn't quite, because I need to know how clocks behave. And for that, I need these different surfaces, which I've just been describing you. So to get from this geometry, which is conformal geometry, that's the geometry that this Escher picture respected here. That's conformal geometry. It's angles, if you like. Well, in space-time, conformal geometry is light cones. That tells you all the angles. That's all you need to know. Whereas the full geometry is the light cones together with the crowding. Okay? So now we know what conformal geometry is. Now, what does Paul Todd say? He says, okay, the metric geometry here goes singular. Densities become infinite and so on. So the crowding of these surfaces goes wild on you. However, the light cones behave perfectly nicely. And so this is the hypothesis now, this biocurvature hypothesis, which describes the geometry of the Big Bang. It says the Big Bang was like something which could have extended, like in the Escher picture, could have been extended to something on the other side. So we say, what was before the Big Bang? Well, it's this region out here. Now, that's just a bit of mathematical trickery, if you like. It's just a mathematical trick. I've got it written there, you see. It's a mathematical trick. And that's the way we looked at it for a long time. But there's a question here. Is it just a trick, or is there something more to it? Well, there might be, for one reason, which is rather important, which is actually the following. Well, you see, how do you build a clock? Well, ultimately, to build a clock, what you really do is you take a particle. Doesn't make very good clock, but any particle will have a mass, and that mass, according to Einstein, is equivalent to an energy, E equals mc squared, there you are, a famous formula. There's also the Planck formula, which is not quite as famous, but just about, which tells you that E, the energy of a particle, if you like, is some constant, Planck's constant, times the frequency. Putting these together, this tells you that the mass and the frequency are directly related. So that there is naturally a frequency. Any particle has a natural frequency associated to it. And any kind of clock has to depend ultimately on having some mass somewhere. If you didn't have any mass, if you tried to build a clock just out of electromagnetism, you can't. And there's a good reason for that, because electromagnetism is what's called conformally invariant. What that means is that electromagnetism is only interested in the light cones. It doesn't care about the crowding. However, mass does, and mass tells you directly what the crowding is. Okay, so it's mass that tells you what the full geometry is. The conformal geometry, that's the light cone geometry, is what you get if you didn't have mass. That's not quite accurate, but that'll do for the moment. Now, when you get close to the Big Bang, what happens? It gets hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter. It gets so hot that the energies of particles get far greater than the masses of the particles. Well, we probably all heard about the LHC and whether they might find the Higgs particle and all that. Well, the Higgs particle is either responsible for or something closely connected with the masses of particles. When you get closer to the Big Bang than the temperature, which is corresponding to a mass of the Higgs particle, then effectively particles are massless. So they basically don't have any mass down there. So they don't know the geometry of the crowding. All they know is the conformal geometry. So if I only know the conformal geometry, how does it know that the Big Bang is there at all? It might as well, you might have gone right through. Okay. I'll just keep that thought for the moment. I'm now going to talk about the other end of the universe, the remote future. Well, the extremely remote future. Now, this is, when I say extremely, I mean extremely. In fact, much matter will collapse into black holes. Eventually, the expanding universe cools down to lower than, well, there's a thing called a Hawking temperature that a black hole has. It's very, very cold. All the black holes that we have any reason to believe in this universe are incredibly cold. You have to think in terms of the coldest temperature that's ever been made on the Earth, or colder, depending on how big the black hole is. Bigger holes are even colder than the smaller ones. Very, very cold. But as the universe expands, it will get cold too. And especially with this cosmological constant, it will eventually, it'll take a while, but eventually it will get colder than any black hole that's around. Then that black hole will be, it'll be hotter than the rest of the universe, and a rather extraordinary thing takes over. According to Stephen Hawking, this was some very remarkable series of deductions he made. The black hole has a temperature. When the ambient temperature gets lower than that of the black hole, when the universe cools down, and then it will radiate away. And as it radiates away energy, it gets less massive. As it gets less massive, it gets hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter, and finally it goes off pop. Now, it might have said bang rather than pop, but it's not that big an explosion. It would be pretty unpleasant if it went off in this room, but it would not be, people on Mars wouldn't interested in it, let alone the ones on the next galaxy. So it's a tiny explosion. That's why I'm calling it pop. Now, there is a thing called the information paradox, which I'm going to come to shortly, but for the moment, the black hole just goes off pop, okay? Eventually. Oh, it takes a long time. It takes a jolly long time. Black hole of the size of the mass of the sun would take about 10 to the 64 years. The universe has only been around for about 10 to the 10 years. For a galactic scale black hole, most galaxies, or as far as we know, all galaxies, contain huge black holes in their centers. Our galaxy contains a black hole of about 3 million times the mass of a sun. There are lots of bigger ones around. Some of these might take about 10 to the 90 years, or 10 to the 100 years. That's the thing called a googol sometimes. Might take a googol years before the black holes all go away. Long time. But when it's gone, there's practically nothing else left in the universe except massless stuff. Okay, there might be a few stray electrons running around, and they worry me a bit, but there might be some rogue electrons. Well, I want them to go away too, so I hope you give me that. That's for the pure philosophy. One would like all massive things to go away. Maybe a few electrons don't matter too much, but let's suppose they all go away. Give me that for the moment anyway. And if there's no mass left, there is no way to build a clock. So you can't build a clock in the remote future either. So the remote future doesn't know. Okay, here I've drawn this boundary in the future. Now this really is the Escher picture in space-time. It's just that. This is the Escher picture, but drawn for a space-time. And so the remote future, it's again a mathematical trick. It's one we've used for many decades now. If you wanted to study what happens in the remote future, you use this conformal squashing in, and I'm squashing it back down, and you make a nice surface, a nice smooth surface, and you can pretend there's some space-time on the other side of it. A mathematical trick, just pretending it's there. Okay, well, here's the punchline. Of course, you probably saw it coming, didn't you? The punchline is that maybe, there's something, connection between these two. That maybe the remote future, it loses, see, one way of saying this is the universe sort of loses track of time. It knows the conformal structure, it knows the light cones, but it doesn't quite know how big it is. It's sort of lost any way of telling how big it is. Actually, there's another way of putting this, which was really what started me thinking on these lines, you see. I thought of how unbelievably boring the universe seems to be. You see, it goes on expanding. Okay, there's some black holes around, that's quite interesting. But then they evaporate away. I can't think of anything really more boring than sitting around waiting for that blasted black hole to decay away for 10 to the, a googol years. I mean, that's boring. If you want boring, that's boring. But then I thought, well, who's going to be around to be bored by that? Not us. Only things like photons, you see. Since the line is going along here, it doesn't experience any passage of time at all. I think I should go to this picture. Here we are. See, these are ordinary particles, but a photon, it takes forever to hit the first surface. It doesn't experience any passage of time at all. It's not going to be bored by that at all. It's just going to go zap. Eternity is no big deal to a photon. It just goes zap right through, you see. So that's the idea, that is the crazy scheme. What we seem to have of our universe, you see, is a nice, smooth, initial singularity can be stretched out, infinity can be squashed down, and maybe you can do them both. And the picture now is that our universe is what I'm calling an eon in a succession, an endless, perhaps, succession of eons. And it's very smooth right across from one to the next. As long as you're just interested in the conformal geometry and not the metric, if you don't care about the scalings, just the light cones and not the clocks, then these things will go smoothly from one to the next. And that is the scheme. The question is, how is it that the entropy can be going up and up and up and up and up, and it seems to be very low on the other side? And it's a very subtle reason that you get away with it in this picture. And that has to do with the fact that, although I didn't address this question because I shoved it over to the edge here, there's a thing called the information paradox, which is what happens to the information in the sense of this phase space volume when the thing has gone pop. You see, all the time, stuff is falling into this singularity. It's drinking up all the degrees of freedom that fall into it. Now, when Stephen Hawking originally proposed this sort of scheme, he thought the information was lost. And I agreed with him. I thought the information was lost too. But nowadays, people don't like that very much. And you'll find that most physicists who think about this problem think somehow it must escape in some way. Now, even Stephen Hawking, a few years ago, publicly agreed to lose a bet that this information was lost, is what you previously thought, and he thought that, well, maybe it isn't lost, and was prepared to publicly to lose this bet. Well, I think he was wrong to lose his bet. I think he was right originally, that the information is lost. And in this scheme, it absolutely needs to be. And not even in this scheme. When you think about it, how to make sense of how the entropy in the Big Bang and the entropy in the remote future can somehow match up with each other. And that's, you have a problem even if you don't have my crazy scheme. The only way I could see how to make that work is that the information is lost. And what that means is that you sort of lose phase space. So it's not as though there's anything that goes against the second law anytime. It's just that somehow the volumes that Mr. Boltzmann uses for his definition of entropy here somehow all get thinned down. It's because the degrees of freedom get swallowed up by the black holes that the volumes don't look as big as they were before. It looks as though the volumes get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and suddenly they get thinned down again because of all those black holes disappearing, and the entropy is allowed to come down. Okay, if you don't follow that argument, it doesn't matter too much, because the key point is going to be something else. I did ask this question at the beginning. Is it true? Well, there is a way of finding out. You might think that all these universes, or all eons, I should say, how are we going to ever find out what the one before us was like, for instance? Well, there is a way, in principle at least. And whether you can in practice is an interesting question. So is it true? Maybe we can find out. And the key thing which seemed to me to be something we might take into consideration is the following. This is meant to be the eon prior to ours. This is our eon, and this is us. Now, in this previous eon, there will be black holes. If it was like ours, of course, it could be completely different, but I'm going to suppose that it was like our eon, that the physics was more or less the same. In that previous eon, there would have been black holes in galactic centers, and there will be clusters of galaxies, and these galaxies every now and again run into each other. When they run into each other, we see that happening. Certainly they do that. When these galaxies run into each other, now and again, their black holes in their middles will get perilously close to each other. Maybe they'll miss, and they'll go right through. Now and again, they will get close, and they will spiral around a bit, and maybe swing out, maybe they will swallow each other. That's a thing that can certainly happen. And in the process of spiraling around and swallowing each other, they will emit vast amounts of energy in the form of gravitational waves. These are ripples in space-time, ripples of Weyl curvature, in fact. These ripples of Weyl curvature will carry away a sizable part of the energy in those black holes themselves. I don't know what the percentage is, but you might think in terms of 5 or 10%, which is pretty big. And then it'll keep happening. These black holes will spiral into each other, and then they will spiral into others, and they'll grow and grow, and there will be lots of bursts of gravitational radiation. These bursts of gravitational radiation will leave their mark on the crossover between one surface and the next. The Weyl curvature in these waves actually goes to zero, but there will be an effect which will disturb the matter on the other side. There's some uncertainties about this which need to be sorted out, but nevertheless, the general expectation is that these will disturb the temperature in the microwave background that we see. As we look out at it, they will be slightly hotter or slightly colder, depending on whether the collision was inside or outside, well, far away or close. The picture I think is good to think of here is imagine a pond, and it's raining, and each drop of rain will cause a ripple to come out. After a while, these ripples are meant to be like these encounters here, you see. After a while, the rain stops. That's when all the black holes have evaporated away, after a Google years or so. The rain stops, and what you look at the pond, well, you see just a rather mess of ripples. Now, if you were clever enough, and there are pretty clever people around who can do this kind of thing, I can't, but they can, what you do is a statistical analysis on this to see whether this pattern of ripples was to a large extent made up out of individual impact points of raindrops. So what I'm saying is that in the black body radiation, the microwave background that we see coming at all directions, there are very, very slight variations in the temperature. Can you see any effect like this? Ripples, which look like circular patterns in the microwave background. Well, about 6 months ago or so, I've been lecturing about this thing for a while, and I'd say this, and then, you know, nobody would make much response. I thought, that's all right, I can go on saying these things. But then I went to Princeton about 6 months ago, actually partly because I wanted to see if anybody might help in looking for these things. And I talked to David Spergel, who's an expert on such matters, and I asked him, is there any evidence in the microwave background for these ripples? And he said, no, but then nobody's ever looked. And then he said, but it wouldn't be hard to look. Give me a week. Or maybe 2 weeks. Perhaps I'll give it to a student if I haven't got much time. Okay. I came away from Princeton thinking, you know, I'm sort of quite excited about this, and then I start to worry about this, you know. I can't give this kind of lecture anymore if they look and they don't find these things, you see. So I, you know, this never happened to me before. So anyway, I had to give a talk in Cambridge. I think it was about a month after this, and I still hadn't heard from these people. And so I hurriedly, he had given it to a student, incidentally, and I then emailed this student and said, look, I've got to give this lecture in Cambridge. Can't you, you know, tell me what's the answer? I want to know, you see. It'll be all right if you tell me, say, 3/4 of an hour before the talk. I'll just look, you see, you see them or you don't, and then I can say this at the talk. Of course, that was completely stupid of me, because he did. He came up with these graphs and things and these histograms, dozens and dozens and dozens of them, and I look at these things and I can't make head or tail of them, you see. So I had to say at the talk, well, look, I really don't know. Okay, that was a while back now, and it's been a rather these sagas, ongoing saga. I thought I'd like to tell you the latest. The latest information was something I got last Friday. Last Friday, you see, I should say that they see, that's the sort of picture of the sky. And that's the microwave. They plot it in this kind of elliptical shape. And the idea was to see whether there are circles, maybe hot, slightly hotter or slightly colder than the background, by simply averaging over circles of different radii and so on. And the first pieces of data they showed me showed that there were some deviations from randomness, but they weren't sure that they really meant anything. And I didn't know myself. After quite some time, I think a couple of months it was, the conclusion seemed to be that the little spikes you saw, the very greatly deviating from randomness. Let me show you some pictures. I think if I talk about it in terms of these pictures, it might be clearer. Okay, they sent me things looking like that, you see. And there were lots of little spikes at these sides, and they thought maybe those spikes meant something. Well, the conclusion seemed to be they didn't mean anything. So that you weren't looking at very big circles, very, very hotter circles or colder circles than the average. And so they didn't seem to be there. They shouldn't have been there, actually, I thought about it, because they were too big anyway. At least some of them were too big. But they seemed to see sort of certain bulges here, which could be the presence of circles. Or they could be something spurious. That means they don't really mean anything. There's something to do with the galaxy, and you're not really looking at the background sky or something like that. So I had the following crazy idea. Okay, maybe we can tell if they're really circles or not by taking the sky and twisting it. You can't really twist the sky, of course, not very easily. But what you can do is take the data. Now, this is data from what's called the WMAP satellite, which plots the temperatures all the way around. You take that data and you plot it on by twisting, imagining it's twisted. Now, this twist is where this picture comes in, if you can see it. This is what an actual circle would look like. This is what a circle would look like after you've twisted it. So if you still see the same effects with twisted circles, then it doesn't mean a thing. If it goes away, the more you twist it, then you're really looking at circles. Okay? Friday, this last Friday, he sent me these pictures. I think those are the ones I want to see. It doesn't matter. I could show you these ones too. Now, these pictures, this is the sort of place I was looking at. Now, you see, there are three. The solid curve is just the random, the Gaussian curve. This is one, this is another, and this is another. Three kinds of circles. The circles, the stretched ellipse, and the very stretched ellipse. And I look at this, and I see all over the place, yeah, here we have a nice one looking way off the curve. Another one looking closer, and they always come in the same order, green, red, blue, green, red, blue, green, red, blue. So I thought, oh, that's confirming my ideas. And then I look at it, and it says red, green, blue. Now, what on earth does that mean? Because that seems to mean that they're seeing ellipses, not circles. And that doesn't make any sense. At least, I couldn't think of what sense it made. The only thing I thought is, maybe they got the colors wrong. So I said to this chap, I said, look, are you sure that red isn't green and green isn't red? I didn't quite say it like that, but you know what I mean. And I just got the message back, I think it was the night before last. No, it's absolutely right. Green is green and red is red. Well, either it's still not right, and green is red and red is green, and then it makes sense, and then there's good evidence for circles, or you really are seeing ellipses out in the sky. Now, if you're seeing ellipses, what on earth can that mean? Particularly because if you draw some more of these ellipses, you'd find they would be kind of pointing one way up here and pointing, doesn't make any sense. But then I thought to myself, it is just possible, although I'm not sure this works, but it's just possible. Remember the pictures of the galaxies and the lensing and the Weyl curvature and all that? Maybe our galaxy is causing circles in the sky to look elliptical. Now, I'm not sure the effect of our galaxy ought to be that big, so I'm worried about that. But let's suppose for the moment that that's right. Then that means that, okay, not the ones in the middle, because these are right in the way of the galaxy, but just above and just below, you're actually looking at distorted circles. and that they really are circles in the background, and they're distorted by the galaxy, something in between. It can't be the whole story because they're all pointing the wrong way, or half of them are pointing the wrong way. But that doesn't matter too much, because if you see circles, you'll see the ones that you see. And if some of them are pointing the wrong way, it doesn't matter. I hope you understand what I mean by that. But anyway, it did seem to me, if the galaxy's effect was big enough, and that's probably a simple calculation that I'm too stupid to do, but if they're big enough, this might be the reason. This might be the explanation. I don't know. I told you I was going to leave you with a question, not an answer, and that's the question. But I'm afraid it's not a clear answer. Maybe next week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, next month, several months from now, it might be clear what the answer to this is. Maybe they're spurious, maybe they're really there. I'm afraid I don't know. Sorry about that, but this is the best I can do for the moment. Thank you very much.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.